Welcome to Rockhound Talk Live. My name is Amber Nicole. I'm your host, Amber Nicole. This is my co-host, Ben Cord, and our intro has been completely ruined. So welcome. Oh, goodness.
Hey, everyone. It feels like we've had some kind of a long break, I think, because of the eclipse, even though it's still been just our normal, you know, few weeks. Something's been thrown off.
Yeah, like on my side, like it's still lagging. So if I cut out, that might actually happen. So, but moving forward, so you've had an interesting time. You did something for the first time during the eclipse.
Yeah, I was able to go down to Arkansas finally and do some quartz mining, which was great. So the first day we went down there, which was the Friday, we actually met up with the Arkansas Crystal Girls, which was really cool. Got to, you know, hang out with Jen and Nisha and meet the new third Arkansas Crystal Girl, Drea. So that was really cool.
Went to Flash.
Yes, they just have they got a new Drea is their new third Arkansas Crystal Girl. Awesome. So it's really exciting. And then we mined for solution quartz at Flash Mountain, which was a lot of fun. And then we went to a few other mines. We went to Twin Creek Mine, did some pocket digs. We did some tailings mining at Avent. And then we went to the Sweet Surrender Mine to watch the eclipse. And the whole time everyone was like, you know, we're not sure if it's going to be cloudy. And I was like freaking out because I'm like, okay, we drove all the way to Arkansas to watch the eclipse and then it's supposed to be cloudy. But then as it kept getting closer and closer, they were decreasing the chance for clouds. And then the day of, it was perfect. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. And I think it scared a lot of people off because they were like, there's going to be 1.5 million people in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And there really wasn't hardly anyone. It was really nice. So I was really happy to be able to get down there. I was a little disappointed just because I was expecting to find like a ton of really big things, and I still have to clean a lot, so I'm probably going to be pleasantly surprised when I start cleaning things. But we had some people in our group that found some like really nice, like I'm talking like big, you know, almost 6-inch
clusters.
Probably crystals, like, no, like full crystals, like six
oh,
inch
wow.
like crystals, like huge
what?
Ones. So, wow. Yeah. So our group overall had some pretty good luck. So, yeah, I just got to clean up a bunch of stuff and then, you know, I've just been busy with other stuff too. Back in November, I believe it was, Chase the agate dude does his Toys for Tots drive, and I actually offered up to take some people to go look for agates. And I actually took someone out this past Sunday to go look for agates because she had won like the trip to go and look with me, and she found a 12.6 ounce agate, which was huge. And it was like really great because I was like super worried because you never know when you go looking for rocks, like you
right.
might find something, you might not.
Right.
For someone to like pay and like me sort of doing like my first like guiding experience with someone, I was like so nervous because I was like, you paid this money. It was for charity. Like, I so hope that you find something. And she was like over the moon, and then she found some other really good ones. So
yeah,
it ended up
great.
Working out really good. But I saw you did some stuff for the eclipse too.
Yeah, I took my kids out to Lake Erie. You know, it was something that we've done for a few years now. And I was just thinking, I hadn't gone hunting at night with my two youngers and me, the three of us, in like 2 years. Usually it's like just me and one of them, just for like kind of our own time together. So it was the first time for all three of us together. So that was really special. And it was the first time that my youngest, because he would always go and look and just be like, you know, like it was just like whatever. But like he actually got into it and he found some really good ones. My daughters always find some good ones. So we had a fantastic haul that night. It was really great. Just to find, for those who don't follow me on Facebook, and I posted, we were hunting fluorescent sodalite on Lake Erie. So we stayed in Huron, Ohio, which is, we had like 3 minutes and 52 seconds of totality. So, and I literally have had that planned out for 7 years. So I had my hotel booked a year ago. I had this in my calendar from the last solar eclipse. So like I already had this whole thing planned. So it worked out perfect because where we go hunting was right near there. So yeah, it was fun. We went hunting the night before, we saw the solar eclipse. So yeah, it was fun. It's always a good time.
I'll say if anyone is ever thinking about going to see, I think the next one's in like 2040 something. If you're thinking about going to see the next one, like go. I couldn't believe too how fast it went. Like this was supposed to be like twice as long as the one in 2017.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and
it was.
Like it once, and it's crazy because it is like totality or bust. Like once totality hits, it's a completely different thing. Like experience, everything is dark. We were seeing, you know, you could see Venus and Jupiter in the sky too. Like it was that dark, you could see planets. Like it was so crazy. If anyone is thinking about trying to plan for the future, like do that. And then I'm probably not going to be around, but I did see in 2099, it's actually going to go through Minnesota. So if I end up being around for over 100 years, I might be able to see another one without having to move anywhere. So,
who chase them. So, you know, there are people who chase them because it's so exciting that it's a hobby for some. So there's always other places to go.
Yeah. I heard, I had a friend on Facebook who was talking about the next one, which I think might be 2026. He was talking about going to Spain cause it's supposed to be like right outside of Madrid. And I was like, that would be cool. But, I don't know if I'd want to be traveling that much. I was so worried about the crowds. And I think with the forecast being kind of cloudy, it kept people away. So I was really happy just I so much like to, you know, mine and do things more like secluded. And I was so worried, you know, people are like, oh, these mines are going to be packed full of people. And some of them were, we tried to go to Wagner's late one day and he was closed, but he said he had hundreds of people there for the eclipse. So we planned it out right. And we're at the right places where we didn't have like these crazy crowds, but so our guest tonight, if you don't know, is Dave Verbioff. He is a owner of a gold mine, and he also mines and buys and sells gold. Pretty much anything that has to do with gold, he is involved with it. So he's got some really cool stories, and the photos that he sent are amazing. So if you happen to be watching this, or I'm sorry, if you happen to be listening to this later on like Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever, make sure you make your way to YouTube to watch the recap of this, to see some of these photos, because they are amazing. But I'll stop talking about it and we can actually go through it. And let's welcome Dave.
Hello. Yes. Hello.
Oh, one other thing. If you don't follow us on YouTube, definitely follow and click the bell to subscribe so that you get notifications when we go live.
Yes.
So, Amber, one of the things that you just said, it's pretty darn funny, as you said, for the last couple of years. And I want to, I didn't realize it until this morning, but my dad was the one that took me gold panning when I was 11 years old, and that was 50 years ago. I'll be 61 this year. And this morning I realized today is the 5th anniversary of his death. And he is my number one. He's my number one hero. He will always be my number one hero. I've got this life because of him taking me gold panning for the first time when I was 11 years old. There was 5 nuggets in that first pan, and that was it, man. My life was written in that moment. So 50 years is a couple more than a few. And it's, you know, like, it's the only thing I know how to do. It's the only thing I want to do. And if I had to do it all over again, I would do exactly the same thing. So
it sounds like it impacted your life that much. It's insane. So at the age of 11, you did your first panning and you've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, I've been around the world. I've been to Australia twice. I've lived in a tent in California for 4 months. I've lived out in the desert in Nevada for weeks on end in the back of my car. I travel to Mexico 2 or 3 times a month. We're working down there. I've got a crew, 2 crews of people down there. Going to Brazil and Chile in the next month. You know, like anything to do with gold, I'm there. I've done the Tucson Rock and Gem Show for 26 years. I own 4 mines, actually, Ben, not just one. And looking at buying another one in Arizona this spring or this fall. And yeah, so, you know, it's an interesting life. I've not worked a day, for the last 30 years, I've been full-time in the gold industry, and I haven't worked a day in those 30 years.
Well, you do work, but just not that kind of work.
physically, I exert a lot of effort, but, you know, it's a labor of love. It's just like,
yeah,
there's just nothing that you can literally name anything to do with the gold industry. And I've done it. I've been a refiner for 8 years, did my own refining. I've cleaned up old major mine sites. I've hunted for placer gold. I've cleaned out old equipment. I was on a reality show 8 years ago because I was chasing gold in the city. That was on Nat Geo. You know, been there, done that, never do it again. They want you to,
you know, stuff. I hear that a lot. I hear a lot from people who do that, do those shows, that it's like a one and done, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, they want you to say stuff that you would normally never say, and stuff you want to say, they won't let you, and they want drama. And I'm like,
yeah,
not me, man. I'm just not interested. You know, I've had 3 shows get a hold of me. I own the Colorado Quartz Mine in Mariposa with my partner, Tony, from Australia. It's one of the most famous mines in the world. And in fact, you know, that was another life-changing endeavor as well. You know, when we bought that mine 8 years ago, there was one thing I knew about hard rock gold mining. One thing only. And that was that in the first year, most companies go broke. And that was all I knew about hard rock mining. I didn't know anything else. I'd never been underground. I swore I would never go underground. And now that's the only place I'd rather, like, that's the only place I want to be. In fact, I do underground mining primarily.
And with that mind, too, I was listening to something where you're talking about the Colorado Quartz Mine. And I believe you said that it was like a 6-year hiatus that no one had like been in the mine and it was flooded. And then you had to get that going. And then I correct me if I'm wrong, but you went for like 17 months without finding anything. Is that right?
Not exactly that. So it's interesting. And that's true. The mine had been flooded for 6 years. So Lance, the guy that we bought the mine from, he hadn't been there for 6 years because he wound up getting a property up in Colorado near Cripple Creek. And the Colorado Quartz Mine was his retirement to himself. But then all of a sudden he's back to work. So he sold it to me and Tony. And he came to get us set up because, you know, he knew the mine, and we started pumping it out. And it took 3 or 4 days to get down to the first level, which is 80 feet underground. And so when we got underground and Lance was still there showing us the ropes, we wound up finding a random piece of gold in an old working. We wound up calling it the mini dragon. It was a piece of gold on quartz about that big. And, you know, Lance didn't stick around to see us recover it, but he was like happy that we found a piece of gold. He says, well, I sure hope it's not 100 ounces. And it wound up being maybe 2 or 3 ounces, but super nice piece. And then after that, it was 17 months till we found another piece. And then it gets crazier than that. So there's a couple of videos I sent you in WhatsApp, Amber, and you might want, might want to show that one. So, you know, when I went panning when I was 11 years old, that first pan had 5 nuggets in it. That changed my life. And then there was another piece of gold and it was called the Angel. And I found it on January 12, 2017. I remember specifically my best friend's birthday that day. I called him that day and I said, I think I just found one of like the most incredible piece of gold ever. And it was a 1/4 ounce and it sold for more than 6 figures. And I have now doomed myself to chasing the rarest, most elusive gold there is. So after we found the Angel, we were finding pretty good gold for about a year. And then on March 4th, 2020, which is right when the pandemic started, I found my biggest piece ever. It was 17 ounces of crystallized gold underground. And then 3 years mining every day, 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, 9 grams of gold in the next 3 years. And that that's the elusive nature of the rare crystallized gold. But I'm doomed. I have to now find something better than the Angel. So that's why I'm traveling all over the place. And I'm in a location now where we're very likely to, you know, I'm very likely to find a piece that's better than that one. And in fact, the funny thing is, haven't found anything here for probably 6 months, like nothing, not a speck, not a flake, nothing. But this afternoon, we did get a signal in the wall. It's very faint, which means it could be deep. It could be ground noise. I'm not sure yet. But right when we started digging in this spot, the excavator wound up having a fuel problem. So I had to run into Placerville today, bought some fuel lines, bought some, you know, so my hands are dirty because I was changing fuel filters right before I got on this podcast.
So you're not in Mexico right now, right?
No, I'm in Central California.
Oh, okay. Because I didn't know if you were going to, so which mine you were talking about. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm in Central California right now, up near Tahoe, Placerville area. So yeah, I'm going to Mexico Saturday. Because we started a brand new property down there on Monday. We got a D8 on site and they found 7 or 8 pieces the first day. But where we're digging down there, there's over 1,000 holes that are hand dug from hundreds of years ago, like 400, 500, 600 years ago. And some of these holes are 20 feet deep. They're 10 feet across. They're spaced out all over. And there's never been equipment in there or metal detectors. There's been metal detectors on the surface, but we actually now have leased the property to, you know, go in with equipment, and we're going to run a dry washer and then obviously detect everything we can with detectors. And, you know, they found pieces today. Go ahead, Amber.
I was going to say, so I have a question. So you've mined gold all over the world. Yeah. And I've talked to you for, you know, the last few months, and, you know, you're between California and Mexico. So yeah, my question is, of all the places in the world to find gold, why have you, you know, decided to primarily mine in Mexico and California?
Well, California is arguably the place where the rarest, the most beautiful crystallized gold in the world comes from. For example, that's a natural gold crystal. This came out of the same pocket.
Oh, it's just incredible.
This came out of the same. This is 23 grams. It's probably the best single crystal out of California ever. Like, everyone that I've showed this to in Tucson, high-end dealers, museums and stuff, they're like, they swear it's Brazil, but I know it's not. This is better than the Brazilian gold. And that came out of the same pocket as
Holy
that.
Cow.
Yeah, that's the one. Oh,
yeah. I was gonna say we can get into, you know, you just showed some examples, but if you don't mind, let's get into some of the photos that you sent.
Yeah.
Because I think so. The one thing too, if people are, you know, trying to, usually when they think about gold, they'll think probably about jewelry and then maybe about nuggets, but it's pretty rare to find crystals. So,
correct.
I don't know. Can you tell me some about what's on the screen here?
Yeah, the one on the left, that's Mexico. And so one of the things is there's different terrain down there. We're in a really dry area right now with no water, but in one of the areas that we do go into, we do have water and we're able to actually do screening and washing like you see on the left. The picture in the middle, that came out of the property that I'm on right now. So we found that one 8 or 9 months ago, cleaned up. It's just a spectacular piece. I don't have a cleaned up picture right now. The one on the far right, it came from a place called Alamos, Mexico, which is in the Sinaloa, Sonora area. That's a Mexican piece, and it's crystallized as well.
And then these, it looks like this is some different mining. Could you maybe like describe like what you're doing here? It looks like you're using water.
So, yeah, what this is when we use a bulldozer, we will bulldoze an area to expose, you know, we usually scrape down 4 or 5 inches and then we run metal detectors over that. Well, what we do is we stockpile all the material at the end of the property, and then we're able to take these piles of dirt that we've pushed up and, you know, we get whatever gold we can with metal detectors. And then the rest of this stuff, we wash it through sluice boxes. So we have a sluice box, a ground sluice, it's called, down on the bottom. And then we just wash the material through to recover the gold there through, you know, regular gravity methods using water. In some places, we have to use what's called a dry washer, and there's no water available. So it goes through a big piece of equipment that has air in it, and it pumps air through the riffles, blows off the light material, and they're about 85% recovery for your fine gold. But we do get the stuff that we miss with metal detectors because some gold is too small for metal detectors.
Okay. And we had sort of talked about this before we started, but so you posted about this on Facebook. And this is, you were saying, so this is like an example of just some of the crazy geology that's going on where you're mining?
Yeah. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. And, you know, I don't know geological terms. I had AI write that description. Just I said to AI, so, you know, I've had a lot of flack from the geology groups on Facebook. They're like word salad and all that shit. And I'm like, yeah, like, you know, I can give you basic definitions and I know where to look. I know what, you know, where the gold typically deposits itself. So this has so many different things happening. And the thing that I don't show in here is there are slick insides on this property too. Everything in this area was just boiling and moving and plastic and hot and wet. And, you know, the carbon and the mica were leaching out of the solutions into the fractured cracks of the sandstone, the andesite, the soapstone. There's a layer of soapstone that's 10 feet thick. There's seven different colors of soapstone. It goes from green to black to blue to white to brown to red. And we have decomposed hematite, quartz, and slate. We have banded slate. And the thing that's really interesting about this area is there's nothing that we've been able to definitively say, okay, this is the vein that we want to now chase, because the pockets are randomly throughout different strata. We're getting gold in the slate. We're getting gold in the soapstone. We're getting gold in the sandstone. Nothing in the andesite, even though there are some quartz veins going through it. You know, and a lot of people might not know this, but andesite is seriously hard. It's a hardness of 7 to 8. It's like granite. And this and the Colorado Quartz Mine, which I own in Mariposa, it's an andesite dike. It's about a 12-foot wide dike in between the slate, you know, that got thrust up when the North American and Pacific plates collided. This andesite is just fractured into just small bits and pieces and fragmented. And I've just never seen andesite do what this is doing here. It's just garbled up and everywhere.
So the one question...
And to clarify... I was going to say real quick, Ben, for people who are listening or watching, this is your property, your mine in Mexico, correct?
Say that again.
This is the mine in Mexico that we're talking about.
Well, this is Central California.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Okay. Yeah. So I was, so what's kind of blowing my mind as a geologist and knowing about how crystals form is you need to have space. So they need to have space to be able to grow into. So you think about like a geode, it's hollow because it's got space and the crystals grow into it. So when you find this gold, is it the gold is like growing into space that's there? Or was it like forming in like solution and then it got stuff around it? Like how do you know at all how this is forming?
Well, it's all theoretical for sure, especially with gold crystals, because gold crystals are really, they're the rarest of the rare. And most of these crystals are not, in fact, grown in vugs. These are encased in solid rock. In fact, the Van Halen, which is on the far left, you couldn't see any gold in the rock at all. There was just a little point of it sticking out. And then when I started prepping the rock, that's what showed up. And so what happens is most people think that gold comes up out of the ground, melted, you know, in volcanic lava and stuff, but that's not the way it is. Most of the gold that's formed in the form of crystals, it comes up in your hydrothermal solutions that has all the dissolved minerals in it. You got your carbon, your iron, your graphite, it's got copper, silver. And then the theory is, and there's just no definitive answer for this, the theory is that what happens is the reason gold is deposited in certain locations around the world, for example, Alaska, California, Nevada, they theorize that as these superheated solutions are coming up into the mantle, what'll happen is there'll be a micro earthquake. And what happens is you get this micro earthquake and then this high pressure superheated solution loses pressure. And it's kind of like a pressure cooker. If you have a pressure cooker on 15 PSI boiling on your stove and then you take the lid off of it, everything just, the minute you take the pressure off, it just drops out of the solution. The theory is that the gold does the same thing. And then your silicates, for example, the quartz, or in this case, we have some arsenopyrite and stuff. They come out at the same time.
Okay.
And the theory is that the crystals form almost instantly, just like bismuth.
Oh, wow. And I can see that. See how it looks too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask. So like where are these all from your California mine?
The one on the left is from it's from California. Now I didn't find these two pieces. I bought these pieces. I'm working with, there's a couple of best friends. They found this pocket And I've been buying the gold for the last 4 years. I've bought everything that that pocket's ever produced. And it's not far from where I'm at here. It's, you know, somewhere across the river. That's all I know. I don't know the exact location, but I do tell people Michigan Bluff because it's close enough to that. And the Michigan Bluff area is really well known for the Eagle's Nest mine is on that side of the river. The Red Ledge mine is over there. So it's over in that direction somewhere. That's as best that I can do. And, you know, understandably, like, I wouldn't tell people where I'm finding gold either.
Right.
And then, Ben, as you know, what I was just talking about with the hydrothermal solutions coming up with the dissolved minerals in them, this is a really, really incredible piece. Okay. It's very crystal clear to see that that's pyrite. So you'll see that this is iron pyrite. You can see the gold is actually growing through the pyrite itself.
Is that like the kind of like needles or like thread kind of coming off of that?
This isn't. This one is more, you can see the gold right here along this one edge, and then the quartz obviously on it, and you got a nice pyrite crystal on the front. So okay. this is a super rare occurrence. A lot of times you don't see fool's gold and gold together.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's a very unique piece. I've had it for probably a year and a half or 2 years. Some gold, I just someday I'll sell it. Someday, you know, like when it's a weird piece like that, I wind up keeping it. But you know, it's one that again in Tucson, I had it there this year, and a lot of people are like, wow, I've never seen anything like that. And I actually have one more piece from the year. And I know that this one came from the Scott River area in California. I know that's where it came from. There was some other pieces that came out of there. I don't know where the other one is. Too much gold, I guess. But I see some questions in the... We should answer some of the questions. We have... So Suze is asking, gold is amazing. If you're new to gold mining, what tools would you recommend someone to start with? There's one. Well, the very first tool is your eyeballs. Most people discount the value of being able to identify where you might find gold. So, you know, your eyeballs for sure. And a gold pan is really what you need to get started. And I will, even now I'm a hard rock gold miner, but when we're into an area and we start seeing some new veins show up, if we're not detecting any gold, we'll scrape some of the vein out, crush it, and pan it to see if there's any fine gold in it. So a gold pan is your number one tool. You know, you want your little crevicing tools. A rock pick is usually very handy. And start there and see if you like it first, because the basics are fundamental to being able to find the type of gold that you're seeing here. You gotta be able to identify, first of all, the difference between gold and pyrite. And the best way to do that is in a gold pan.
So I wanted to show one video that you had sent. I think it kind of shows, like, you know, some of the ways that you use like metal detectors when doing this.
Yeah.
So let me see. Angel.
Oh man. David has a big sound.
Oro.
Oro minero.
So Oro minero. You can tell we're in Oro Mexico. Edgar.
Oro minero.
Oro minero.
Hermano de oro.
That's my crew down in Mexico.
It's a big, big sound.
That's quartz right there.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Very hard.
Yeah.
Oh, man, amazing.
Granite and quartz, sulfides.
This is about 600 years old, by the way, this mine.
So it looks like with this, then you're using the metal detector to sort of find your the spots that you want to target, and then you're digging in those spots. Is that right?
So when you get a signal on a metal detector, it is a piece of metal. And, you know, at that point, you're recovering whatever the target is. So the other thing I want to point out about, you know, me being shirtless there. So I've got these two underground mines here in California, and our underground temperature's about 55 degrees underground. Down there, it's almost 80 degrees. Yeah, we're pretty much due east of Mazatlan where we're at down there. So it's freaking hot. And even underground, like, the walls are warm to touch. There's bats that have wingspans, like, you know, huge wingspans. There's scorpions on the walls that are about this long. They're called a vinaigrette. is what it's called. And they're tailless. They don't, they can't sting you. They just, you know, they eat bugs and stuff and they live in the dark, but a real, real wild experience.
So with that, the one thing I'm curious about, you know, I've been told, I'm sure a lot of people know this, like gold is relatively soft.
It is.
And you're using, you know, like metal, you know, tools, it looks like. So is there, do you just like try to get close to where you think it's going to be and then switch methods, or like how do you do that so you don't damage the crystals? Because those, you know, I could imagine that would be heartbreaking to damage something like that.
Yeah, with a metal detector, you're able to, once you've used a metal detector well enough, you're able to determine exactly where the target is. And if it's, if the rock is really super hard and we're not able to manually dig it out, I do have an air powered diamond chainsaw. So it, you know, we can cut out a large slab of rock and then we take the whole thing to the surface. And then we, you know, it just depends on the size of the piece. And sometimes the rock's not as hard as that. We can dig out around it. So yeah, you use the, you know, your pick is your first piece of equipment that you use. But then after that, we use power tools. You know, like I said, we have a chainsaw that's got diamond blade on it and it's air powered, water cooled. I've got videos on my YouTube channel showing me using it. And in fact, the first time I ever had to use that saw, it was Super Bowl Sunday, probably in 2016. I don't care about football. So I was underground working and I found that was the after the 17 month dry spell, that was the piece that we found. It was called the Super Bowl pocket. And I used the chainsaw to cut that piece out. And so I've got videos on my YouTube channel showing me use that thing. Pretty wild equipment, you know, and we have air chippers, we have chisels, jackhammers, drills, you know, licensed blasters. So we use, sometimes we have to blow out a little bit more rock. And so we, you know, drill around it and we'll, you know, set off some very light charges and things like that. So.
So with the metal detector, I'm kind of curious because I've only done metal detecting once and it was on the copper tailing mines in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah.
And it was basically, I had the probably the cheapest thing you can get that my fiance, her father had one, I think, for trying to find his water shut off in his yard. And it was basically any noise I heard, I just went ahead and did it. And looking at your videos, it sounds like you're trying to do something with the metal detector. Like, I don't know if it's like the pitch or the sound. Like, could you maybe talk about like what you're, like how you're able to figure out what's gold using the metal detector?
Well, you can't actually determine the difference. Like, metal will make the same noise, whether it's a piece of steel or a piece of gold, typically. And so what I'm doing with the metal detector there, like why I'm going back and forth on it and kind of moving around it, is to pinpoint where the actual target is. So the metal detector is the most sensitive on the edge of the coil. So what you do is you come in from the side and you start wherever you start hearing the signal, you kind of use your eyeball to pinpoint where the tip of the coil was. And then you come from the top, come from the other side, and you're able to determine pretty specifically where that target is. And that's why you can dig around it.
I just want to go through some of the other photos that you had here, because some of these are just crazy. So what can you tell us about these?
The one on the left-hand side is a piece of gold that was found about 100 feet up the hill from where we started working on Monday. It's 5 kilos.
5 kilos, like it's the whole thing's gold?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And that was found 2.5 years ago, about 100 to 150 feet up the hill from where we're at now.
And you said, was that underground?
It was only 3 inches deep. So what'll happen is, as a geologist, you understand that, you know, the natural processes of erosion, you know, gold is formed in the ground. Like, it comes up from the mantle. It comes, gets thrust up when the mountains push up, the hydrothermal solutions come shooting up. And then as the geological processes naturally occur, the gold will erode out of the rest of the mountain and it'll start rolling down the hill. You know, when you find nuggets and stuff in the streams, that's, you know, originally that stuff was underground millions of years ago. And then it gets naturally worn through, you know, being in water and being tumbled and gravel and rocks going over it. And so then a lot of times you'll find, like in Australia, for example, that it's flat. You go into Western Australia, man, it is flat as far as you can see. And the gold is laying out in the flat areas, because the theory is, again, in Australia, is that at one time in Australia, the mountains were higher than the Alps in Australia. And then they've all been eroded down into just a flat desert hundreds of miles. It's just flat. And the gold is just laying out in the desert wherever it eroded out of those mountains.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it, so flash in the pan was checking 5 kilos?
I did say 5 kilos.
Wow.
That's 165 ounces.
Jeez. And what are these other two photos here? Are they the same?
Those are the same piece, actually. That's two views of the same piece. And that's a piece of crystallized gold. It's been in the water. You can tell by the rounded edges on it. It's slightly worn. It's not as sharp as the Van Halen or the other crystal that I showed you. But at one time, before it wound up getting into the stream beds or the river or whatever, that one would have been as razor sharp edges. And this one's from Yukon, Canada, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The one on the left and the one in the middle, that came from the property I'm on now. That was the last piece of gold we actually found about 6 months ago. The very last piece we found. Still have it.
Okay.
And then the one on the right, that's a piece of Yukon gold. You know, I've been buying and selling gold. I don't know when I bought that one years ago. And, you know, I buy and sell a couple hundred ounces of gold a month.
And so with these, like I'm noticing some of them, they've got like some slight color variations. Is that something that's just because of like the dirt or the purity, or like, I'm guessing the one on the right's been kind of like tumbled a little bit. Like what's causing the color differences?
Well, again, so gold is never pure when you find it in nature ever. It's always got, well, that's not true. Australian gold is about 99% pure. It's typically the purest gold on the planet. So it has sometimes just a little bit of silver in it, but when you get into the Alaskan gold, it'll have copper alloyed with it naturally, silver with it. You get sometimes you get iron with it. You'll get other minerals with it. So it'll cause different colors. Nevada has gold as low as 75% pure. It'll have, you know, up to 20% silver in it with a little bit of copper. So it just depends where the gold comes from based on the purity. California gold is anywhere from 83 to 87% pure. Alaskan gold, same thing, 83 to 85, 86, 87 as a general rule of thumb. Montana gold can get as high as 98%. And so it really just depends on where it came from, whether it was found in the rock. The one on the very far right, that one obviously, again, it got eroded out of the vein millions of years ago, wound up in a stream bed somewhere. And then got dug up and, you know, washed through a, you know, wash plant, or someone might have panned it or metal detected it. So those two pictures on the left and in the center, the same piece we were just talking about, just four different views of that same piece. But you can see kind of the stepped little look. It almost looks like bismuth. That's called hoppering. So a bismuth crystal is called a hopper crystal, and gold will do the same thing. And it's a very actually sought after form of gold. It's hoppered octahedron is the actual terminology for that. An octahedron being an eight-sided crystal.
And so I was listening to some of your videos, and there was some terms for just different quartz features. I was wondering if you could maybe like talk about some of them. I think one of them you mentioned was like trigons.
Yeah.
Could you maybe talk, because, you know, I've never seen crystallized gold that I know of in person. And I'm sure there's like a ton of just like descriptors that you can use for them, and you know, they're just, it's so interesting. So I just wonder if you could like mention some of the different characteristics.
Yep. So wire gold, you were talking about this earlier, that's wire gold.
Wow. And it's just like, it's almost like just fibers, like asbestos, almost, but it's,
yeah, gold. And then if you look at these under a loop, you'll see that there's little microcrystals on each one of the wires. And it's seriously cool. Here's another piece of wire gold. This is from Folsom, California.
Oh, wow. It's really yellow.
Yeah, it's super yellow. Super yellow. This is a little higher purity. And then you can see on the backside. So this is a really killer piece that came out of the Folsom area probably 7 or 8 months ago. This is some octahedrons. This came out of the same pocket as the Van Halen as well. Again, it's another very unusual crystal. It's also very yellow. My lighting in here is kind of sucks. I've got LED lights in my motorhome. And so those are octahedrons. There are spinel twin wires. There are octahedrons. Trigons is a three-sided shape. Typically, you'll find the trigons, like you'll get leaf gold, which has been extruded through the cracks. And a lot of times when that forms, as it's cooling, it'll form little trigon bumps. So it looks like little pyramids on the surface of the foil the leaf gold.
Okay.
And those are kind of the major pieces or major crystal structures for gold.
So is there any one that's like, I know, you know, we've kind of worked up to like gold crystals are really rare. Is there like the rarest, like what would be the rarest crystal of gold?
Big razor sharp crystals are, you know, your best. So there's not one in part. Like, here's the other thing that's interesting about that is, you know, collectors are the ones that usually buy this kind of gold because it's far beyond the price of gold. None of this stuff is even close to the price of gold. And collectors really have the type of gold that they prefer. So there are some collectors that collect wire gold only, or there's some that will collect gold on matrix only. Like, this crystal being as killer as it is, if someone wants a piece of gold on matrix, and a lot of collectors do, they wouldn't buy this even as incredible as it is. This would be an octahedron or a deformed octahedron. This is a hopper crystal. You can see the step sides on it. So, you know, just for example, this is 26 grams and it's $50,000.
Wow. Stop. Holy crap.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so that's why I'm doomed, right? Like, I'm chasing the most elusive gold, but, you know, I'll go 3 years and not find anything. And then you find a piece that pays for the next 2 or 3 years. Like, all the gold I find when I sell it, it's just so I can keep doing what I love doing.
So how do you decide when, you know, you said you're getting ready to buy another mine. How do you decide that this is the mine you're going to buy?
The type of gold. And the mine in Arizona has got really wild crystals too. And, you know, I'm going to keep that a little bit under the wraps for now until we make the deal or not. But it has a really wild type of crystallography as well that I haven't seen before. They're really interesting. Dodecahedron, 12-sided crystal, 16-sided crystals. And they're very unusual.
Ben, did we, I know I had to switch over to my phone. Did you show the picture of that one piece of gold that looks like leaves? It's like really big and it's like at the crystal. It looks like a leaf. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I'm not sure.
I haven't seen that one yet.
Oh yeah. No, it's coming up. Yeah. Let me go back to some of these photos. Cause some of these are just nuts. So what can you tell me about these? And I guess this kind of too, I guess, goes back to what I was talking about color. Like, you can kind of see, like, I'm guessing, are these from three different places then?
They are. So the one on the left is from Round Mountain, Nevada, and you can see that it's a paler color, and some of the gold from that Round Mountain mine had a higher silver content. But silver also really does help form crystal types that you wouldn't get otherwise. And if you've ever seen natural silver crystals, they do some really wild things. So it does kind of have a little bit of an influence on the way the gold forms. This is probably 18 to 20% silver in that one. The one in the middle, that is from Liberty, Washington, believe it or not. It's from the Ace of Diamonds mine. Maybe I might have that one here. Let me just check. Nope, I don't. I actually have some really cool pieces to show you though. I forgot I had these ones here. And then the one on the far right.
That's the leaf one. Yeah.
Yeah. The one on the far right, that's from where I'm at now.
Oh, that's incredible. Oh my God. That one I love. Oh.
Yeah. And then here's a really wild, you know, I'll give you again. This is from where I'm at right now too. This is leaf gold. This does have trigons on the surface of it. You can't see them until you look at it under a loop. But this was found in the vein. It was folded in half, like it was folded like this. And when I started cleaning it with a high pressure water gun, it just naturally unfolded. And then 2 feet away on the exact same vein and was this one.
Oh, gorgeous.
Wow. And so this is, you know, this is very similar to the one that you like, Amber. This is came out of the same vein 2 feet away.
That's so crazy.
2 feet from each other in the same vein, you have these two pieces.
Wow.
And that's why I love the crystallized gold so much, is because when you get a signal, you know it's gold, but you don't know what it's looked like. And it's like I don't know, it's like playing a slot machine or putting a quarter in a gumball machine hoping you get your favorite, you know, like you just never know what it's going to look like.
Right.
And so that's why, like, every single time I get a signal, whether it's a big or small signal, I never know what it's going to be. So, you know, it's crazy. The one on the left, I don't know. That's probably an Australian piece. I don't remember that one specifically from many, many years ago. The one in the middle, that's another piece from British Columbia. That's from Atlin, British Columbia. And then the one on the far right, that is my partner, Tony. That's his nugget. It's not mine. It's from Australia. It's 84 ounces, I believe. He had that one.
Crazy.
Yeah, he had that one. Yeah, he had that one in Tucson this year. So that's an Australian nugget. Tony, you know, Tony Fraser, I met him 25 years ago or 26 years ago in Tucson. We immediately hit it off. When we bought the Colorado Quartz mine, he called me. And, you know, I've just every year, like I've been to Australia twice. I went and stayed with him for 17 days. We looked for gold. And, you know, Tony has the best Australian gold out of every other dealer out there. He's dealt with some of the most famous Australian nuggets that are out there. In fact, he owns a piece of gold called the Thunderbolt. It's 117 ounces. It's like, you know, this tall. He carries it around. When he takes it into the show in Tucson, it's in a violin case.
Wow. That's so crazy.
So with these, like you mentioned, they're nuggets. So for something to be a nugget, does it have to be like a placer or like, I guess, could you maybe explain the difference between like a nugget and then like the crystals?
Yeah, for sure. So nuggets are typically, again, you know, all this gold was originally formed underground. It came out of the vein somewhere, wound up in a river or a dry desert somewhere. It was, you know, it's just not in place anymore. Not where it was formed. It's now in place where it got to by being eroded out of the original source. And so nuggets are pieces of gold that are not in the lode or in the vein or in, you know, it's not just quartz veins that gold forms in. And then anything else would be either considered lode gold or specimen gold. So you get a piece of gold in quartz. It might not necessarily be crystallized. It could be what's called crystalline. And there's a differentiating weight. So crystalline gold is gold that's still in quartz, but it doesn't have geometric structure.
Okay.
If we refer back to the piece that you said that you loved, Amber, mm-hmm. you can see actual geometric structure. To
yes.
It.
Yes.
And so that's crystallized gold. Mm-hmm. And the one in the middle would be more crystalline because it doesn't really have crystal structures. It's more random. It's just gold that formed and didn't form into cubes or trigons. It's just random, bright colored gold that's in rock. And that's the difference.
That's good that you explained that because I was curious on that because I seen the terminology used and I wasn't sure what the difference was. So I'm glad you explained that.
And here's a really good way to actually frame it in a way that people might understand it. Carbon is a mineral that is, you know, our bodies are, you know, a huge percentage of carbon. It's one of the most abundant elements in the universe. And in its non-crystallized form, it's got a value of, you know, like pencil lead is very cheap. Carbon is very cheap as a general rule of thumb. Now, when you get into the crystallized form, I'll ask you, Amber, I'm going to ask you specifically. I know Ben knows what the crystallized form of carbon is. Do you, Amber, do you know the crystallized form of carbon?
Diamond?
Yeah, diamond. You're 100% spot on.
I'm like, is this supposed to be a trick question?
That's not a trick question. There's other people that might not know, right? Now, if you think about the price difference between carbon as the mineral, the black mineral that we all know that you cook your steaks with, and a diamond, it's drastically different. And it pretty much, it's the same in the mineral world. It's like quartz crystals are worth more than just white bull quartz.
Right.
Any crystallized form of a mineral is rare for one, and then obviously a lot more valuable.
And, you know, I'll just say, like, I mean, maybe in the gold world, but like, you know, like rock hounds in particular, I would say that most of us don't know that there's like crystallized gold. Like, I think that's really cool.
Most people don't. A lot, you know, and it's like I said, I'm doomed. It's like, I wake up thinking about crystallized gold. I go to bed thinking about crystallized gold. Crystallized gold. And I do the nuggets to pay the bills because, you know, again, I'm on a 6-month dry spell, but today maybe we do have something. I'll know here after the podcast. I'm going to run down with the metal detector and see if our signal's a little louder. I heard the excavator running about an hour ago, but we haven't found anything for a while. So, you know, I think it'd be kind of fitting that today would be the day that we do find a piece because, you know, 5-year anniversary of my dad's death. And well, as a tribute to him, it would be just great to find one.
Yeah, that would be great. I will say, going back to your crystallized mineral, I will say that is true for most, but I can definitely think of one that it is not true, which for some reason people have been arguing about this, but ice is a mineral. It fits all the definitions.
Of course it is. Yes.
Of a mineral. So I'd say $20. I'd say, you know, 20 pounds, you can get about $4 for a bunch of ice. So.
Have you tried to buy ice in California lately? It ain't $4. I'm telling you right now.
We do have a question from the Herkimer Diamond Detective asking about, she wants to try gold panning. They've got a friend in Colorado that has land on the Colorado River, and they're wondering if it'd be worth it. So, you know, I guess how do you know where to pan for gold, or do you just go and just, you know, try it out?
No. So it's really a great question. You want to go to where gold has been found before. You know, we're not the first ones walking around looking for gold. And, you know, if you think about the gold rush, 1849, 50, you know, in California, the whole mother load, you know, pretty much anywhere you go, you're going to find at least, you know, little gold dust and flakes in your pan. But you want to do the research. The other thing that I recommend people do is look for local prospecting clubs. A lot of the states have local prospecting clubs. You know, there's the Roadrunner Club down in Phoenix area. The GPAA is a nationwide club. You can become a member. I don't know what the price is anymore, but I did the GPAA shows for years, and they have probably more clubs than anyone. Well, they're the biggest private prospecting club in the United States. I know that. But, you know, in Colorado, there's for sure going to be some small clubs there, and you just got to, you know, get on Facebook. And there are quite a few groups on Facebook for gold, you know, finding gold in Colorado, and, you know, just do your research. And then you go to those areas, see. The thing that's really good about clubs is if you're a beginner, a lot of, you know, the gold mining community, we love making sure that people are successful. We want people to enjoy this hobby. The more people that enjoy our hobby, the more we have an opportunity to have a voice when we have to fight, you know, some of these policies that we're fighting, you know, the Forest Service and the BLM. And, you know, our rights are being taken away. I hate to say it, but, you know, they're closing Forest Service roads. We can't go to some places that we used to. And so the best thing to do is look up a club in the area that you want to go, do some research online, and go where gold was found before. And here's why it would be worth it, whether you find gold or not. You're going to be in the outdoors. You're going to be learning something new. You're going to be enjoying Mother Nature. And you're going to get some exercise and some vitamin D. And you look, you could find some gold. My very first pan ever, 5 nuggets the size of match heads. And that was it. That's, you know, crazy. And yeah, it's really why I sell pay dirt too. People are like, what's the deal? Like, why would people buy a bag of pay dirt or rather go out and find it myself? Well, what about if you live in Kansas or Missouri or Hawaii? There's no freaking gold.
Right.
And people, just because they live in an area where they can't readily access gold, you know, they get to experience what it's like to pan for gold.
And it's also too, like, I'm friends with the Mineral Monsters on Facebook, and they were mentioning, because, you know, they're kids, and their parent was saying, you know, hey, they're looking to get into gold panning. And, you know, it's like, well, you know, it'd be really fun if you're getting into gold panning to actually find gold. And so the pay dirt would be a great option.
It is. It's a really great option for people to learn. And I did see a question a little bit earlier. One question that popped in was saying, man, I used to love your crystallized gold pay dirt. Well, here's the deal. Whoever asked that question, let me scroll up and see if I can see who that was.
SJB.
Okay, so SJB, here's an interesting thing. I'm driving to Nevada tomorrow to buy some crystallized gold to do a brand new run of Nevada crystallized pay dirt. It should be on the website Saturday or Sunday.
Woo!
And this stuff is sick. It's all wire gold. And it's like check out goldbay.com either this weekend or early next week. I'm bringing it back. It's been a while since I've had it because, you know, to get crystallized gold to put in pay dirt is really hard to find, but I did wind up finding a source. So tomorrow I'm actually going to pick it up.
Nice. And just to backtrack briefly, The GPAA, I mentioned this in the chat, but it's the Gold Prospectors Association of America. I want to mention I was doing some research earlier and I did come across that, and I actually found on their website they've got a whole bunch of links for clubs, and I actually joined the Facebook group for one in Minnesota. So it's very easy to find information about that if you're looking into it. And also, we were talking about access for lands. If anyone's interested in getting involved in protecting access to public lands, the American Lands Access Association, or ALAA, is a great resource. A lot of mineral clubs that are part of the AFMS, the American Federation of Mineralogical Societies, are also members of the ALAA. So if you're interested in, they're the ones that have published a lot of stuff about like the Mojave National Monument or whatever it is in California that were going to be expanding their reach and basically not allowing rock hounding in certain areas of California. They were very adamant of, you know, publishing information, you know, here's BLM meetings and, you know, really policy driven stuff. So yeah. If that is interesting, interested to you, then definitely look up the ALAA as well.
Yeah. Another one to look up too is PLP, which is the Public Lands for the People. So I met Jerry Hobbs 26 or 27 years ago. He originally founded it. He passed away a few years ago, but it's a really great group of people, and it really is about protecting the public lands for the people. So PLP.org, I believe, is what it is. Just look it up. It's PLP for sure. And they're all also very instrumental in helping small-scale recreational miners, hunters, fishermen, off-road enthusiasts, things like that. You know, and that's why I'm saying, like, it's really, like, support your clubs, because the more people we have, like, you know, the fishing industry has a huge voice, and we want the gold mining and gold prospecting community to also have that kind of a voice. Because, you know, a lot of times, you know, here's the other thing that people don't understand. If we're running a suction dredge, which is a piece of equipment that floats on the river and it's got a suction nozzle on the end, and you pull up gravel from the bottom of the river, goes through your sluice box, and then whatever you're sucking up off the bottom of the river, it goes right back into the river. You're not actually discharging or introducing anything new into the waterway. And a lot of times dredgers will, you know, will get fishing weights and shotgun pellets and old scrap steel. Like, that stuff is in the streams already. And responsible dredgers, we will remove those foreign materials from the stream bed, and we will take them and dispose of them properly. Like, that, you know, and we will also clean up all the other stuff along the edges of the banks. Like, we really take pride in the fact that we're conserving nature. Yep.
Have you sold that one?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Amber is about ready to sell a kidney.
No, I'm not saying I would buy it. I'm just curious because it's so incredible. I'm like, there's gotta, I mean, how could it not be sold? Cause it's so, like, you know what I mean? Somebody has to want that. It's so gorgeous.
Yeah, well, it's
And I did have to throw in, I did come across one last picture of he's making an appearance right behind us. Uh-huh. Your dog Camo, dressed out in some gold chain.
Yep. My dogs are on the road with me. My old guy's sitting here beside me. He's 17 years old. He's deaf and blind.
Oh my gosh. But
he still gets around. His nose works real well. He goes almost everywhere I go.
Aw, that's
sweet. And he's got 250,000 miles on him.
Oh my gosh.
He's been to Mexico 10 times. He's been to Canada 10 times, all over Nevada, California, Washington State. Like, this dog has been around. So he'll be 17 in August.
So question, I know that you have your mines that you mine. Is that the only place that you're mining is your own mines?
Pretty much. Yep.
Okay. I mean, that seems pretty obvious, but I just didn't know if, like, you were like, you know what? No, there's this one place that I always like to go to, but okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, part of the deal is too, is, you know, people are saying, well, why are you doing anything down south? And it's because, like I said, we have these long dry spells and I got to pay the bills. So, you know, we're able to pay the bills with doing the other type of mining. And again, I'm not on site down there very often. I go down like every couple of weeks, but, you know, I've got a great group of guys. My best friend, Danny, he's down there. My friend, Joel in English, Joel in Espanol, you know, great guys that I work with down there. My Spanish is good. And, you know, the Mexican community and the Mexican miners are just like us. They're just as loco. They run metal detectors, modern equipment, and they get it all, man.
I've seen the videos. Yeah. Like, they're, yeah.
I went down about a month ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, you know, to just go in and, you know, do some metal detecting behind them. And I only found two little pieces. They didn't miss anything. These guys know what the hell they're doing.
Yeah. So Diana asked where in Mexico do you, I mean that like that specifically, but is there a like city that you,
do you know where Puerto Vallarta is?
Not me personally. No.
Yeah. It's down on the coast. Anyways, I'm nowhere near there.
Okay. Okay. We're following you.
Yeah.
What was I gonna, okay. This is going to, I asked you this in our, probably our first conversation. So you were actually talking about, when you're talking about like placer gold and you're and veins of, you're finding, talking about where gold is at, and you were talking about the source.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about that, how there's a concept out there that gold is not from Earth and that it's like extraterrestrial. Can you kind of elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, it's funny. About 2 weeks ago, I actually did a really interesting video about, and again, this is all theoretically, there's just no other theory besides this one. So when the Big Bang happened, if, you know, if we still go with the Big Bang theory for the start of the universe, in the moment of the Big Bang, the universe was 75% hydrogen, 25% helium. And then all of that dust and these molecules of hydrogen and helium, they went out into the universe, and then gravity started to pull them together. And then as they started to clump together, they started forming, you know, smaller pieces of matter. And what happens is you get what's called nuclear fusion. And what happens is nuclear fusion starts to generate heat and energy. And then the helium and hydrogen molecules, they'll start to form into heavier elements. And in fact, what'll happen is you'll get these supermassive stars that are 10 times bigger than our sun. And the heaviest element that can form in a star is iron. On the periodic table of elements, iron is the heaviest metal that can, or the heaviest element that can be formed from a star that goes into supernova. And then what happens is when you get a supernova happening, you get what's called a neutron star, because the star collapses back in on itself and will create a neutron star. And when you have two neutron stars that get in proximity of each other, they will collide. And what will happen is they explode again into a huge explosion. And what happens is that releases an abundance of electrons into the universe. And then these electrons will collide with other molecules that are out there in space floating around. And then what you go from nuclear fusion to nuclear fission. So okay. What happens is you'll start to create these heavier elements that are beyond iron. You'll get your coppers and other metals. And then the theory is that in order to create the heaviest of the elements, and gold is part of this, 79 electrons in a gold molecule, you have to have photons, random photons hitting.
Really?
Yeah. And so it's a wild, every night before bed, I'm falling asleep listening to something about, you know, the universe and the Big Bang and nuclear fission and particles of light and how they interact with other, you know, molecules that are floating around out there. So gold is ultra, ultra rare, let alone crystallized gold. And so that's the most widely accepted theory. No one knows for sure, but yeah, it takes a supernova of a supermassive star, at least 10 times bigger than our star. And then it takes two neutron stars colliding to create the abundance of electrons that then interact with the molecules that are out there freely floating in space. And then it takes photons to, you know, sometimes it'll knock a particle or a molecule or an electron off of a free floating particle of matter out there to create, you know, these other elements that are
on. So then all of those things were necessary. They came together, created gold, and then the Big Bang came and it just blasted into, like, explain that part. Explain the part. So after it's developed, how did it get here?
So while everything that got blasted out from the singularity, so the singularity is what they call, you know, the Big Bang. It was every single thing that exists in the universe was in a what they call a singularity. They figure it was probably 50 kilometers across, and that is everything that exists in the universe now was super compressed, super compacted, super dense. And then when it exploded, it was an instant expansion of the universe to unfathomable, unthinkable, you know, size that we have now. You right. know, the James Webb Space Telescope is now kind of putting a little chink in the armor. They actually now think that the universe is actually 29 billion years old. They don't know for sure. And that's because some of the supermassive black or supermassive galaxies that they're seeing that were supposedly formed 400 million years after the Big Bang are too big to exist 400 million years after the Big Bang. So there are some things that are now having a lot of, you know, consequences in the widely accepted theories.
So yeah. And just, you know, kind of to expand on that too, you know, we can see stars and their relative position and correct. See that they are moving away from a central point to realize that, you know, because the universe is still expanding today. Mm-hmm. And so you can actually.
It's expanding faster than it was. So the redshift mm-hmm. of the galaxies that are the furthest away, the James Webb Space Telescope, that's what I'm saying, is these redshifted galaxies are bigger than they should be. So the universe is actually increasing the speed of the expansion, and they can't explain it. No one knows why. Mm-hmm. And it's actually expanding faster than the speed of light. So there are galaxies and stars that we will never see because the light will never get to us. It's expanding too fast.
Yeah, it's something really interesting to think about. Someone mentioned this to me and it's like lived rent free in my head forever. If there is an alien race out there that has a telescope and they can see planet Earth, and let's say they are 70 million light years away, they are looking at Earth and seeing dinosaurs. Because that's the light
crazy, right?
is 70 million years old and when dinosaurs were on the Earth, and they're yeah. seeing dinosaurs and yeah. thinking, oh, the Earth is run by dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's yeah. crazy. Like,
it's just crazy, like, to think about some of that stuff. The formation.
Yeah.
yeah, and you know, and just going into, you know, like, the formation of Earth and how, you know, you basically have a bunch of stardust that starts to combine and become dense, and then, you know, more it gets denser and attracts more material, and then it starts to separate, which is why we have a heavy nickel core and all this. Like, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, it's what makes people geologists. I'll say that. So,
well, the other interesting thing about that too is that, you know, the Earth formed and then a very small microplanet collided with the Earth and jettisoned off material that formed our moon.
Yeah.
And the moon has way more helium-3 than planet Earth, but there are similarities in the rock structures that are out on the moon. Like, there's meteorites that have hit from the moon, which are super rare, by the way, to prove that the moon was at one point some part of the Earth when it was in a molten state, and that, you know, this microplanet collided with Earth as it was still in a very young state.
I think that makes sense to me. Like, when I think about just that theory, completely makes sense to me.
Yeah. And then there's another, and, you know, speaking of the water on the planet, it's like, where did all the water come from? Because the Earth was a molten blob of superheated, you know, rock and heavy metals and materials. And just like two or three nights ago, I watched a video on where did the water on the Earth come from? And one of the most widely accepted theories was, you know, there was a bombardment of comets, which is comets are a lot of water and ice. But they've also now proven that rocks that were hitting the planet carried most of the water. And there's more water. There's more water underground than on the surface of the planet. Far more water underground
than the oceans.
Yeah, far more.
What?
They theorize as much as twice as much water in the mantle and down to, you know, where it's molten, there's more water underground than there is above ground.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hmm. Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, not to get too derailed in all of this planetary stuff, but I know the one thing I've been following, like the one thing I can get lost in, because it was like sort of a dream of mine when I was younger, is to, you know, work with NASA and be an astronaut and all this stuff.
But yeah, that's cool.
If you can find some really cool people that work for like JPL and NASA on like Facebook and Twitter and stuff, that they are just like, they're not at the top and they're not, you know, but they're just like really interested in the stuff that they share is so cool. Like all the stuff about Mars and how they have so much evidence that there was water on Mars and it was flowing yep. and causing all of these landforms. Absolutely. And then now there's not you know, it's not there. It's, you know, it does have like an ice cap, but you know, some of that stuff is just mind blowing to think. And then, you know, kind of going back with the mining stuff too, there's so much out there about, you know, some of these asteroids that are out there have all of these these rare elements yeah. and materials that it's like, if someone can get there and come back, which I know SpaceX has been doing like reusable rockets, cause that's where a lot of the high costs are. But you know, it's just amazing to think about the fact that we're doing like underwater, undersea mining. And we're talking about trying to get asteroids to get these rare minerals that are just sitting out there. It's, you know, someone's going to be smart enough to make a lot of money off of this.
Yeah.
Yep. And in
so
the meantime,
so much more to learn.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, I've been doing this 50 years. I learn every day. In fact, you know, when we got this signal earlier today, I'm like, I would have never picked this spot to be one of the spots where there's gold. And that the rule of thumb, you know, there is a saying in the gold mining industry, gold is where you find it.
Okay. Can I ask a question about that though, before you go on with that thought? Okay.
Yeah.
When I first heard that, I thought like it was supposed to be sarcastic. Like where does that originate? And can you elaborate on that? Because me, as somebody who's not in the gold world, like I don't get it.
Well, it's real simple. So, you know, the Colorado Quartz Mine is a real good example of this. There were some fairly consistent areas where we would find gold. Like we could tell that there's what's called crenulation. So that gold mine is, there's, so the slate got, you know, upthrust when the North American Pacific plates collided, formed the Sierra Nevada Mountains, Yosemite National Park. You know, I'm only 18 miles from Yosemite down there. All of this stuff was happening. And so these slate beds, they got thrust up like this. And then there's a crack mm-hmm. that's about 18 to 20 feet wide that got filled with this igneous rock called andesite.
Okay.
And then as the andesite started to cool and fracture and crack, which, you know, hot rocks, as they're cooling down, it does that. And so what would happen is there's these little ripples that would happen in the andesite. And when we had gold veins running through these crenulations, on the high side of this little ripple, we would typically find pockets of gold. So we were in an area where we were doing really well. We were finding a lot of gold. Some places we'd blast and we'd find 14 or 15 different targets. It would be gold every time. And then we would blast the next time. We would blast a little higher up and we would think for sure there's going to be gold there. Boom, 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 boom. No gold.
Hmm.
Nothing. I've got a video on my YouTube channel and I think it's called the November 24th pocket or discovery and recovery of rare gold crystals or whatever.
Was that like 2019?
Probably right around there. It's a 47 okay. minute video, 47 minute long video. It's really unedited. I swear a lot in it because I'm excited as when we find this gold. But I found one of my favorite pieces of gold. I called it the, you know, November 23rd pocket. It's one of the most beautiful gold crystals I've ever seen. It was on a quartz crystal. The gold was super bright. And you can see us recover it underground. And I spray it off. I spray it off with a little, you know, like a water sprayer type thing. Mm-hmm. And you just see this thing just go crazy brilliant gold. And it was one of my favorite finds. That's where the old adage comes true. It's where you find it.
Not okay.
where you expect to find it. You know, a friend of mine, his name is Nico, probably 3 or 4 months ago, he had never really been looking for gold in the red, you know, the iron rich soil that we have here in California. Australia is famous for it as well. Arizona has a lot of it. Down in Mexico, there's a lot of it. Red soil, we're looking for that. But he was not typically looking in those areas. And he found just a stunning, stunning, stunning 4 ounce gold nugget, very shallow.
Mm-hmm.
Place that he would have never thought to look until he, you know, saw some of my videos. And so again, it's like you want to go to where gold was found primarily, but here's one thing I can say about that. This is really perfect. I just thought of this. This is for the beginners primarily. When people go to an area where gold has been found before, a lot of times people will go right down into the stream and they'll be digging in the bottom of the creek and putting that into their pan. And then that is not recommended. And here's why. When the gold is in the waterway or in a stream or in a river, you got to realize it's been there for hundreds or thousands or millions of years even. And gold being 19.3 times heavier than water, specific gravity is 19.3, it is at the very, very, very bottom of all that river gravel. You can find what's called flood gold, which is, you know, if we had a really high runoff this year, you'll get some smaller pieces of gold that are typically in the riverbed strata. But if you go to an area where gold has been found before and you're working beside a stream, what you want to do is you want to work away from the water and you want to try and find exposed bedrock. Mm-hmm. And you want to crack the bedrock open. You want to break the rocks open. You want to dig out the cracks. And so you want to be away from the water where you can actually recover all of the material that goes deep into the cracks of the bedrock. You want to look for any little depressions, or you got to realize that the river and the stream are where they're at now, but a million years ago, where was that stream when the gold was deposited? So if you look at most of these gold mining shows, you're going to see that they're not working in streams with their excavators and their bulldozers and stuff. They're way up away from the waterway. They're in the old ancient channels, the old tertiary channels, the old tertiary gravels. You know, when we were covered with ice because of the last ice age, the glaciers, they pushed a lot of this gold from way up north, from Alaska, northern British Columbia. All that stuff got pushed and scoured along, but you know, that was 1,000 feet higher than the riverways are now. So you want to look in the areas where there's exposed bedrock, and you know, metal detecting in those areas is good. And even with your gold pan, go crack the bedrock open that's away from the stream.
Yeah,
scrape that stuff out.
And that's also something I've been telling this to people too, like looking for agates, especially in Montana. There are so many old deposits from the Yellowstone River and some of the areas where the ice sheets have been pushed down, that if you get outside of the riverbank, you can find some really great deposits that people don't look for because they know it's in the river. They know that there's gravel there and that's where they go. But when you go to, like, I've shown people maps, and I'll see, you can see on the satellite image this old gravel deposit, this oxbow of where the river was, and I've been there and I've looked, and it's full of cactus, and it's not entirely fun to hike through sometimes, but it's full of agates. And yep. It's the same that we, every year our mineral club goes to Montana and we go to a private ranch and everyone goes through this creek bed. The first year I was there, I started going literally up a hill. And on one hill, I found, I want to say, 3 or 4 agates, and one of them was over 1 pound and the other ones were over 2 pounds. And yep. It was all on one hill. And it's, I keep telling these people, like, you don't need to know everything there is about geology, but if you look for where, like, the water has been, mm-hmm. or where, you know, everything has been, you can get to places that people don't get to and find, you know, and it doesn't have to be agates or gold. Anything that's been washing down out of those mountains, whether it's, you know, sapphires or topaz or, you know, whatever it is, you can find that. Yes. Yeah. If you can understand where things were, then you can understand where things are just waiting for you to get there.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I want to say about what you just said too, and this is again for everybody that's listening, Google Earth. It's an incredible, incredible, incredible tool. Like, I cannot emphasize how much time you can save yourself. Use Google Earth. If you're going to a gold bearing area, man, like, use every bit of Google Earth on the area that you plan on going in. You can see your outcroppings. You can see quartz veins coming out. Like, Google Earth has super high resolution.
Yes.
It's super great. It's one of your best prospecting tools again. And that's why I said earlier, when we started this podcast, your eyeballs are your number one tool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So there is, I did have at least one more video I wanted to show. I wanted to show one video. I know we showed one while you were in the mine. I just wanted to show this other video of you, like, going into a mine. This might be a couple minutes long, but I wanted to show this one because it's cool. A little bit crazy.
Yeah.
Matando la mina. This is the same one in Mexico.
This is crazy. Just crazy. This is wild.
Yeah, that's where I love being, man.
It's just wild.
And these are all just hand-dug tunnels?
Yeah, this is probably 500 years old.
That's crazy!
I have a theory about this mine, too, and I can tell you after the video.
This is wild!
2,000 feet of tunnel on this mine, all hand-dug.
It's crazy! My mind is just blown right now. Like, what?
Yeah, 80 degrees underground.
It's just crazy.
Well, you can see scorpions on the wall, actually.
Like, the level of trust that you have with your team down there is incredible. I mean, because this is just like, I mean, you can't, you're not going to just go down any tunnel.
Amazing,
you know?
Dave. Beautiful.
This is just like my mine in California.
Really? Almost exactly. It's similar, very similar.
Yeah, look at the court.
Oh, man.
Look. This is a real interesting.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, this is
a very crazy gap.
Yeah, this is all hand dug.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Mira, holy.
Look at camera. Dave.
What the f- Woo. Hey.
Jambusinos. No, me first. Okay. You wait to see this is cool.
The video ended.
So much fun.
There was over a foot thick chunk of quartz in there. So I have a theory about this particular spot. It's probably 500 or 600 years old and all hand dug. And it's a really interesting area. It's my theory on this is that the material that was hand dug, it's a breccia and it's on top of an old ancient seafloor because when you go in, you can see that they were right above the seafloor that got pushed up. There's seashells and phosphates and everything else. And then there's this random conglomerate that solidified into rock. My theory is that all of this stuff that's on top of this old ancient seafloor is from when the Chicxulub meteorite hit and it jettisoned millions and billions of tons of material. You know, it created the huge crater in the Gulf down of Mexico, and all of this stuff, I think it just got thrown like 150 to 180 miles out to where we're at, and then it all came down, landed on top of what was already there, and then it solidified into a metamorphic type breccia or metamorphic rock, because there are no continuous veins of quartz. There's granite, there's obsidian, there's chunks of quartz, there's some rounded off rocks, there's sharp rocks. It's wild and there's over 2,000 feet of tunnel, but I can't see anything definitive that they were chasing. I think that there was just, you know, gold got deposited when all this shit got jettisoned out of the ocean 65 million years ago, which was the demise of the dinosaurs.
I guess this mine that you own down there, like, what is it? There's crystallized gold there then, correct?
In one area, we are getting crystallized gold. We've been finding that recently. And then in the other area, it's all nuggets.
Because that's your primary thing. Because I was kind of wondering, like, is that what prompted you to go there then with the crystallized gold?
Yeah, just, you know, I hooked up with, you know, Joel, Joel, he's in the video, and then some other, you know, he's the guy that reached out to me probably a year ago. He'd been following me on Facebook for 6 years. And, you know, we talked a little bit back and forth. And I finally had him fly out to meet me in Tijuana. I was down there with my best friend, Danny. And I said, you know, I want you to be here when we meet this guy just to make sure he's the real deal. Within 2 seconds of meeting him, I knew he was the real deal. Immediately within 2 seconds, you know, when we drove away from that first meeting with him, I said to Danny in the car, I said, he's the real deal. And he goes, I can tell. Yeah, and Danny hasn't really been prospecting yet, you know, but Danny, he's down there right now. He's away from his wife and his daughter, and he's on the project, and he goes for a month at a time and then goes back to Tijuana. But, you know, Danny's down there, and he found his very first piece of gold with a metal detector. And, nice. You know, he's now a Gambusino too. He says, I can't stop thinking about gold.
He got the gold fever.
Look at Tamil. He's so excited. He's like,
oh, he's so cute.
He's like, it's dinner time. he's my headrest always.
So I did have one question. So I was kind of going through your story. So I know, like, when you were 11, you found, you know, 5 nuggets of gold and you got into prospecting. And then there's sort of a gap, you know, as far as, you know, you got into gold and whatever. But I saw that you owned like a pawn shop.
I did.
Was that just like more so that you could maybe find like gold, or like to have funds to go find gold, or like, how did that fit in?
Well, it's just, you know, it's all part of it is, you know, when I started buying and selling gold 26 years ago, I didn't really have a good way to source gold. And I started buying gold from American Coin and Vault in Spokane, you know, and I met a guy named Bill Graham, became super great friends. And I remember one of the things that he said to me is, and this, I still live by this adage. He said, a fast nickel is better than a slow dime. And so when people say, well, Dave, you've got the best prices, how come you sell stuff for so cheap and your payer is so good? And two reasons. One, I want people to get a fair value for their dollar. And two, a fast nickel is better than a slow dime. So I'm like always, you know, buying and selling gold to be able to pay the bills for those dry spells that I have. You know, to make it as a full-time gold miner, just mining, it's probably easier to become the next Van Halen or the next David Lee Roth than it is to be successful as a gold miner. And so, you know, I've just got my fingers in every aspect of the gold industry that I can. And so opening a pawn shop was a way to, you know, buy gold, make a fast nickel is better than a slow dime. And I would pay more for scrap gold, and I became a refiner, and, you know, I never stopped prospecting for gold nuggets and metal detecting for gold and dredging and panning and traveling all over the place. So a pawn shop was just a vehicle for me to, you know, have an extended income beyond the gold mining.
And so the one thing I was reading about too is, you know, you kind of had some advice. So if someone, say, comes across some gold and for whatever reason they want to sell it, what sort of advice do you have for them for that?
Well, there is the very first piece of advice that I'm going to give, and I'll have some people that'll argue with me, but if you find a rock that has gold in it, or that you think has gold in it, do not crush it and pan it. I see so many people on so many of these Facebook groups say, crush it and pan it, crush it and pan it. Well, guess what? This piece here, you could hardly see any gold in it whatsoever. The only thing you could see was this little tip on the end. There was just, it was solid rock. And if that was crushed,
it'd
be worth $1,500. But as that specimen, it's worth astronomically many, many, many times more than that. So do not crush your rocks. Get someone that knows what they're talking about to look at it. Do not take your gold to a jewelry store. Do not take your gold to a pawn shop, even though I owned one. You want to talk to someone that specializes in natural forms of gold.
Okay.
You know, jewelry stores, there are some smaller jewelry stores where you may have, you know, in a gold baron area, like in Alaska and northern parts of British Columbia, there are jewelry stores up there that will, you know, treat you properly with that. There's a place in Placerville that I go see him all the time, and he pays gold miners fair because he specializes in raw forms of gold. So there are some places that are reputable, but a lot of, you know, the old adage was, you know, take it to a jeweler, let them tell you. But, you know, there's not many jewelers nowadays that specialize in natural nuggets and rare forms of gold, particularly if it's in the host rock or it's in a rock. So reach out to me, like get me to at least give you some advice. I've got a lot of people that were crushing their gold in the central mother lode area that used to do that. But, you know, I get people reaching out to me every day. Hey, I have this available. You want to look at it? Give me some advice. How much gold is in it? You know, and you can tell how much gold is in it by doing what's called a specific gravity test. Again, it's on my YouTube channel. There's a video that shows you how to determine how much gold is in a rock by weighing it dry. And then you submerge it in water, you weigh it again, and then you do a mathematical formula on it. Archimedes came up with that test 600 years ago, and it's called the Archimedes test or specific gravity. So you can determine very closely how much gold is in a rock specimen.
And to kind of build on that, I sort of have read about this, but for anyone that hasn't listened to you yet or read about this, what do you say to anyone that finds gold nuggets or whatever and wants to melt it down?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that.
You're going to have... So once you melt it down, you're going to have an unknown quantity of gold because gold is never pure in nature. So when you melt it down, if it's got 15% silver in it, you've got 85% gold bar with a little bit of other impurities in it. You then need to sell that, and whoever you're going to sell it to, they're going to discount it probably by 20% because they have to refine it into pure gold to then be able to sell it back to the market. And you destroy the natural value of gold nuggets and gold dust. For example, there's a theory, again, this is a theory, is that only 5% of all the gold on the planet has ever been mined since the beginning of mining. And only 5% of the 5% is in the form of visible gold. Most of the gold that you see in jewelry or in coins or bullion is large mining companies that are, you know, running these massive trucks. They're crushing thousands of tons of rock. For example, in the Carlin Trend, which is in northern Nevada, they produce most of the gold in the United States. It's one of the biggest gold producing areas in the world, actually, but for sure in the United States. They don't see any visible gold whatsoever. It's all microscopic gold. So what they do is they do crush their rocks because it's what's called finely disseminated gold. And then they'll leach the gold out of the crushed up rock. They'll crush it up into the, you know, powder, like the, you know, consistency of flour. And then they'll use different leaching methods. Like you see, when you're driving through that area, you drive north of Winnemucca over to Ely, Nevada, you're going right through that area. You'll see these huge piles on either side of the road, these huge mountains with sprinklers on them. Well, what those sprinklers are is they're sprinkling cyanide solution onto those piles. And they will do that for anywhere from 5 to 20 years. They will sprinkle cyanide solution on these piles. And these piles are on these huge rubber membranes that are they're impermeable to water. And what will happen is those solutions will then go over to the plant, where they will run it through what's called carbon and pulp process to pull the gold out of the cyanide solution. And the other thing about cyanide, people think it's radically dangerous. It's not. Sunlight breaks cyanide down super quickly. Within a day, cyanide becomes inert from sunlight. So it's not all this harmful, hazardous thing that people think about. And, you know, there's very strict regulations that mining companies have to abide by. They wouldn't get permitting if it was destroying, you know, the environment. So, yeah, don't melt your gold. It's more valuable.
That makes sense. Because I always wondered why people who collect gold, why they don't melt it. And now I get it. You know, I never really understood that. More.
Yeah, once you melt it down, it still has to be processed from there. Like, it's not pure gold at that form or at that point.
Yeah,
and there's something else I listened to also that I think you said it can lose weight because of the fumes, and also the fumes aren't very good as well.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah, so when you find natural gold nuggets, they have a little bit of dirt on them, and you know, when you melt gold, you lose anywhere from 1.5 to 10% of the weight when you melt it. And if you melt it too hot with an oxyacetylene torch or in an induction furnace, it will fume off some of the gold. So you will lose some of the weight. Whereas I buy gold, even if it's dirty, I'll buy it the way it is. And I pay you more than the purity of it because I have a voracious appetite. Like I have, you know, I don't know how many customers, 30 or 40,000 pay dirt customers. And we do hundreds of bags a day sometimes, you know, during the, you know, the time when we were all not allowed to go outside. You know, there were days where we were doing 200 bags of pay dirt a day.
Dang, that's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. I did want to show one last video. I noticed when I downloaded a bunch of videos, apparently I missed a bunch, but I did want to show this one because it's so pretty. So just to go back to seeing some of the beautiful crystals.
Here's another piece that's really, really cool. I'm holding it in the shadow. I'm standing with the sun to my back.
It's so pretty.
And you can see that it's still super lustrous. Check this out.
Ugh. Oh, gorgeous.
Beautiful luster. Looks like a dragon to me.
It does.
All that happened.
Dragon head, the eye up here, where my forefinger is.
Yeah.
flip it over. It's a dragon head the other way as well. Love this piece.
Yeah, that is cool.
And so where was that piece from?
Yeah, I was going to say, where is that?
That's from where I'm at right now.
And how, like, how much work did you have to do to find that piece?
This one was it was found on the surface.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. So sometimes you'll get pieces that, again, gold is where you find it.
Yeah.
And so this was very unexpected. It was after a serious rainstorm
and it
just washed away the dirt, and there it was.
Oh my gosh, that's gorgeous.
So I'm hoping that's what's in the ground tonight when I go back down there.
Yeah.
Well, so how long have you been mining at this mine that you're at right now?
About a year.
Oh, that's it? So you got still a lot more to like uncover.
Oh yeah. No, there's but again, like 6 months haven't found a thing, not a speck.
When do you decide like you've tapped out on a certain location?
I don't. The only reason I'm not mining at the Colorado Quartz anymore, we did shut it down, is last February when we had a 5-foot snowstorm one night, the house collapsed. My roommates were in the house. I was on my way to Mexico and I got a call at 2:00 in the morning. I was in a casino in Tucson and they're like, "The house just fell down." I'm like, "What?" Like they were called. And so the house fell down, and then 2 weeks later, yeah, so the house collapsed while they were sleeping.
That's crazy.
It's still not totally rebuilt, but you know, the guy that worked for me for years and years, he's been rebuilding the house for me. So we're almost completely rebuilt. But you know, a couple of weeks later, part of the mine did collapse from the surface down to level one. It didn't collapse it in a way that we can never open it, but for now I've shut that mine down. It's not going to be anytime soon that I'll actually go back there and reopen it up. I'd have to do probably $50,000 to $100,000 worth of work just to get it back up to MSHA safety standards and things like that. So there's nothing in the near future is going to have me reopen that mine.
Okay.
So that, you know, in that case, it was just a
safety issue. Yeah.
But here it's like, I'm just going to keep going until, you know, something else calls me away from here. But I'm here for a while.
That's good.
Even though we haven't found anything, you know, and it's not cheap, $25,000 a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Well, yep. I know you mentioned that you were getting your excavator back ready to go. So I know we're a bit past as far as when we said we'd be done, but we'll let you get back to it. So for anyone that's interested in our next episode, we are going to be doing a live episode.
Yes.
In Minnesota. Amber is going to be coming out to look for some Lake Superior agates.
Yeah, and it'll be my first time ever hunting for agates and first time in Minnesota. So I'm super excited.
Yes. So it is going to be a really great episode. We're going to be interviewing Wayne Binsfeld, who does Wayne's World Agates. If you haven't heard about Wayne, he's really cool. He does a lot of like sort of agate inspired designs for stickers, but he also does just amazing carvings of agates. He does all sorts of...
I've seen anybody carve agates like he does. Like, incredible.
Yeah, so we will see his collection of agates, we'll learn a little bit more about how he does some of his carvings, and then we're actually going to be out looking for agates. So tune in on May 1st at 8:45 Eastern for that. And if you want to learn more about some of the topics and things we discussed, you can look up Dave at goldbay.com. He's got pay dirt for sale and a whole bunch of other stuff. With that, you know, thank you, Dave, for your time tonight and answering all the questions. This was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun for sure. You know, I didn't know how it was going to go. And I didn't like, I was going to say, well, I hope I don't offend anybody. Cause a lot of times, like, there'll be shit come out of my mouth. But when you start talking, I'm right at home.
It can't be as bad as my technical errors. So it's fine. Yeah. But before we go real quick, I do have to say one thing. So because this is a gold episode, I'm going to take this off. We had on our first episode, Kayla Johansson. Yeah. Dave, are you familiar with her? Okay.
Yeah, totally.
So I don't know if I'll be able to take it off, you'll be able to see. But so Kayla, she does jewelry, and I don't know if you can see it or not.
Yeah, I saw her jewelry on Instagram. It's killer.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is an agate with a gold nugget in the middle.
that she actually collected in Alaska. And so I've got some Kayla Johansson jewelry. So if anyone is ever interested in that, you can check her out at the Peking Dough. .com and purchase her jewelry there. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's Peking Dough on Etsy.
On Etsy, okay.
Yes, it, yeah. I do have a. She also has a really cool. I've actually got one. I need to get a longer chain for it, but she's got a really cool like hammer and shovel with, and in the shovel she's got a little gold nugget. So she's got some really great gold nugget jewelry as well.
Yeah, so if you are interested at all in having some gold nugget jewelry, definitely check out Peking Joe on Etsy. Kayla Johansson, gorgeous. I absolutely love mine.
And if you want to hear some more geology discussions about gold, you can also go back to our season 2, episode 1 with Ellie Ringo, where we talked about some more of gold mining and also her experience on, I think it was frozen gold.
Gold, or yeah.
Yeah.
And that also prompts me for what? Okay, one more thing. So I recently revamped our YouTube channel to where I have things categorized by different niches within like rock hounding and collecting. So like if you are primarily somebody who focuses on finding gold, we have a section for, you know, gold. Or if you primarily collect crystals, we have a section of all of our guests who collect crystals and agates and so on. So definitely check out our YouTube channel. If you're not subscribed, subscribe and enjoy learning from us.
Yes. And just a reminder too to everyone, this episode the audio will be posted on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you can get your audio podcast. This will be up on Sunday. So make sure to tune in for that, and you can re-listen to all of our fun stories while you're driving to your spot, maybe traveling to Mexico or looking for agates or whatever it is you're doing.
Lots of agates in Mexico, too.
Oh yes.
Don't get me started on
Don't
that.
Get me started, because
in Chihuahua.
And everything else, like, we just need a Mexico trip, okay?
Yeah, Chihuahua. I've been invited out to the ranch out there. You know, I've known them for a while. They actually own a pug too, so
we hit it off right away.
But yeah, they've been inviting me to come out and see that. So
that's awesome.
I haven't gone up there yet, but yeah, there's Mexico is just an absolute. It is not what most people see on Travel Channel and all that stuff. Mexico is super rugged, super mountainous, super remote. It is absolutely, it's mind-blowing how rugged.
I need to get a trip out there.
Crazy. Well, you guys have seen a lot of my pictures, like mountains and places that we've been and places that I'm continuing to go, and it's rugged and remote.
Right.
And it's not expensive to go out there either, so.
Nope.
It's on my radar.
I fly from Sacramento to Guadalajara for $30.
That's crazy. Stop. That's crazy. Oh my God.
Volaris Airlines, man. Annual pass. $30 from Fresno, Sacramento, Oakland, Reno. $30.
Wow. That's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to sign out tonight. Peace out, everyone. And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Perfect.
Bye, everyone.